Welcome to episode 13 of Breaking Español. I am your host, Jenny, along with my husband, Ben, sharing our journey into learning Spanish and raising our son bilingual. On today's episode, we have an interview for you with one of Ben's friends, Jonathan Zaidman. He has a really unique family history, as well as just a story about growing up in Mexican culture. And Ben was really excited to have him on. I kind of let you explain.
Sure. So me and Jonathan met downtown working at a co-working space where he has a sustainability project. It's a nonprofit called the One-to-One Movement. And in just kind of chatting and stuff, I learned a lot about him. He's vegan. He's very San Diegan. But he also spoke Spanish one time on the phone, and it didn't sound like when I speak Spanish, right? He's a gringo, but he speaks perfectly fluent Spanish, and I was really intrigued by that back then. Then after we started the podcast, I thought, wow, what an interesting story to hear kind of his culture and how his family came to be from Mexico and how he learned Spanish and just what it's like growing up and what it's like, you know, having this kind of really unique background. So it's, you know, a good conversation with him and talking about all those kind of things. And so I think people will be really stoked on it.
Yeah, I got a chance to listen to the interview and I really enjoyed it and actually learned something new about that kind of history between the Eastern European Jews kind of settling in Mexico City. And then just hearing a lot of the traditions, how they kept up traditions, how his family has even brought, since he was born and raised in San Diego, how they've even brought the traditions from Mexico City, but left kind of maybe some of the Eastern European because it just gets less and less. And so it was really interesting because we are kind of going through a similar thing with raising Jack. We didn't really have a strong influence of traditions growing up, not being in a religious family. We don't have anything too strong that we carried on. And so I really liked hearing his stories about like even the food. He eats Mexican food all the time. And he said with his girlfriend, he hasn't even had I want to say tuna helper, but tuna casserole, you know, very, very American thing. I know I grew up on it. And so I just loved hearing that because it doesn't matter where you are, like you can have those really strong traditions or, you know, it was really interesting to hear that. So yeah, so we really appreciate Jonathan coming on and we hope you guys enjoy the interview.
All right, welcome everyone. We have a really cool interview with a friend of mine, Jonathan Zaidman. Today, he's from the One-to-One Movement, and he has a really unique backstory on how he learned Spanish and kind of his cultural history and what he's doing with his new nonprofit and everything else. So welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you're with One-to-One. Why don't we start there and you just give me a breakdown of kind of what you guys are all about and what you do.
So 5 years ago, we started a nonprofit organization here in San Diego called One-to-One Movement. We do environmental education in schools primarily, but a whole host of community health, sustainability-oriented programming throughout Southern California.
And you have a double-decker bus.
We do. We purchased a double-decker bus recently, because why not? We are turning the top level into a mobile greenhouse, the bottom level into an activity lab, to take to schools to serve as a engaging and accessible sustainable food systems. It's really a mobile classroom.
Yeah. And do you serve just communities here in San Diego? Do you go across the border at all or anything like that?
So with that program, it's called Stacked. We're exclusively in San Diego right now. We have done binational projects, but we're, I'd say, 98% San Diego focused.
Okay, cool. And how's it going?
How's it going? It's going. It's nonprofit is a totally interesting thing. It's especially innovation in the nonprofit space is not necessarily two things that go together.
Yeah.
So we've tried to really disrupt the way in which environmental education takes place by focusing exclusively on hands-on learning instead of kind of traditional lecture-based projects. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely something that the community has seen a great need for and has been supported. And the bus project is a lot of work. There's no Pinterest guide on how to turn a double-decker bus into a greenhouse. It's never been done before.
Yeah.
So it's going, you know, we're learning every step of the way.
Right.
I know a lot about polycarbonate now. I know a lot about a lot of random things that you would have never expected.
And does knowing Spanish in your background at all help in this space? I'm not sure. I mean, or is it mostly just, you know, English speaking people that you come across or anything like that?
Yeah. So we've gotten to the point where I'm no longer exclusively in classrooms. We can hire a full-time educator, which is a really great development for us. But when I first started off with the organization, I did the educational programming as well. And definitely, I mean, we're in San Diego Unified School District is the second largest district in the country, in California. And yeah, we have a substantial Spanish speaking population here. Right. And being able to walk into a classroom looking like a white guy, understanding what students are saying and being able to bust out some Spanish on them, they kind of snaps them back into attention. Like, and they're cool.
That's awesome, man. So tell me about that. We just chatted a bit before our interview here and we talked about how you came to be here and learned Spanish and all that. So why don't you just break it down? Like, let's go 1800s way back or whatever, like as far back as you want to go.
So my four grandparents are all Eastern European Jews, Lithuania, Ukraine, Poland. And during the early 1900s, stuff wasn't going so hot. And their families all decided to leave. So this is primarily pre-Holocaust, where shit was really bad.
Yeah. And well, in the 1900s, is that World War One?
Yeah. So they, I think my grandfather on my father's side was the first to come over. And I think that was 1909. And then throughout the teens and the 20s, the remaining three came.
Yeah.
It definitely wasn't a great place to be, especially in Eastern Europe as a Jew. They all essentially left everything behind, right? Homes, businesses, belongings, and stuffed their families onto ships, which all came to the United States. And most people actually don't know that a lot of the boats that were docked in Ellis Island weren't let in. There was a quota as to how many Jews were let in, just like there was a quota as to how many Irish people were let in.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So
I wonder why, like, who comes up with that?
I don't know.
Somebody sitting in an office like, oh, we can't have too many Jews here.
I don't know.
5,000. Does that sound good? Okay, Jeff. Yeah. 5,000. That's good. Yep.
So yeah, there was a quota. And really sad is that a lot of those ships were sent back to Europe. So people that escaped by the skin of their teeth,
they thought they were
later sent back and were exterminated in concentration camps.
Probably didn't receive a good welcome on the way
back. No, they sure didn't. So a lot of those ships that were filled with people that either brought all of the cash that they had on hand with them, were able to bribe their captains to just take them to any port that would let them in. So Jews ended up throughout primarily Latin America because of the proximity to the United States.
Right.
Jews ended up in Argentina. They ended up in Cuba. So my grandfather on my mother's side first went to Cuba. And a lot of Jews ended up in Mexico as well. And when I say a lot, it's not millions, it's thousands.
Yeah.
If not less at first. So all four of my grandparents ended up in Mexico.
Mexico City.
Worked their way to Mexico City.
Oh, got it. I was going to say, because I mean, from, let's say you're going to New York and you're on a ship, where Mexico City is not close.
No.
Right? That's like a long way down.
Yeah.
Even any part of Mexico is pretty far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know the route that they took. If it was down south through, the Panama Canal wasn't built yet.
Right.
So they must have gone down through South America.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
It's a long, man.
Yeah.
Could you imagine? I mean, is anything in any of our lives ever going to be as difficult as that must have been?
No.
Right.
I can say with, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in the next, you know, 50, 75 years.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think so.
So you can say, gracias por abuelos.
Yeah. So my grandfather, on my father's side, wrote a book. And the first two pages is just printed on both sides, the double-sided, gracias Mexico, gracias Mexico, gracias Mexico, hundreds of times, because he felt lifelong appreciation for this country for letting him in at a time in which literally nobody else would.
I mean, it was that or possible death.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, you're either, you're going to, you know, kick and scratch your way to make something happen.
Yeah.
Right. Wow.
So they all ended up in Mexico, I assume in some coastal community, and made their way to Mexico City, given the similarity between their experiences of living in industrial, capital communities in Europe and what Mexico City was at that time.
Yeah. And even today, doesn't it like 10 or something percent of Mexico people live in Mexico City?
Probably more.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a huge percentage.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mexico City has, they say 25 million people. A lot of those people are undocumented because they're poor or homeless.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a significant portion of the Mexican population.
Right. So they land in Mexico City.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
They
don't speak Spanish.
They didn't, but then they did.
Yeah.
Because they had to.
Right.
Mexico City at that point wasn't the, you know, metropolitan capital that it is today, where, you know, today you can get by in Mexico City speaking English. Today you can get by in Mexico City speaking Chinese.
Yeah.
Right? Just because there's so much business dealing in Mexico City that there's a population of any single type of community right. that you might be looking for. But no, then they needed to learn Spanish. They I would say, didn't bring a great deal of wealth with them, but what they did bring was a lot of institutional knowledge on how to run businesses, how to run institutions, how to run schools like and universities.
Skills and experiences from a more developed part of the world.
Exactly.
Right.
At that point, Mexico City was still really an artisanal state capital. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was people trading stuff. And I think that a lot of the immigrants that came brought these more advanced, I guess, capitalist practices
yeah.
that had been successful in Europe at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And really became successful. And not immediately, but over time
yeah.
now, to the point where this originally small population of Jews and other immigrants that may have ended up in Mexico have become industry leaders in all sorts of different
yeah.
sectors, manufacturing or finance or entertainment or academia.
Yeah. And so we talked a little bit about it, you know, the vast, vast majority are Catholic in Mexico. So do you know of any stories of them having any prejudice against them because they were Jewish? I mean, I imagine there had to be something, or maybe you just didn't talk about it, or...
So as far as I know, no. You know,
okay.
As far as I know, the Mexican community was always incredibly accepting
uh-huh.
of this population that came in. That being said, the Mexican Jews that I'm familiar with, and granted, I didn't grow up there. We'll kind of get into
yeah.
my personal background, but from going back every year to visit family and seeing the community and how it operates, as much as they, I guess, acclimated to Mexico and learned Spanish and really identify as Mexican,
yeah.
They still live in very tightly knit communities.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that pretty much every person, every Mexican Jew goes to a Jewish school.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in private schools.
Yeah.
They all stay in pretty similar neighborhoods, right? You don't have a very dispersed Mexican Jewish population.
Right.
Geographically. So they live in similar neighborhoods. And so as much as the community did become really integrated into Mexican culture, they also still always had their own
right.
cultural identity.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can go into it a little bit, but I imagine, you know, some of the Eastern European heritage, I guess, is going to get mixed in with some Mexican heritage eventually, right? Somebody's going to date or, you know, a Mexican woman or man and, you know, make babies that are mixed or anything like that? Or is it still, it's pretty separate?
So as far as I know, no.
No? Wow.
It is such an insular community that there's very little dating outside of it.
Wow.
And
that reminds me of like Chicago. My grandparents are all Italian. And it was the same kind of a thing. There were like four streets in this part of Chicago where basically everybody dated or got married to everyone else because they were all from the same parts of Italy. Right. And then like,
exactly it.
You wouldn't date or even think of talking to, you know, a guy or a girl two streets over because that was the Polish community or whatever. Right.
Yeah. That's exactly. And it wasn't yeah. born from racism or it was just, this is what we do. Our
yeah.
family talks to this type of family and that's
right.
it. And it's the only people you end up meeting because you go to school together, you own businesses together, you go to temple together. And
mm-hmm.
so as far as I don't know, I'm sure it's happened.
Yeah.
But definitely not.
It's not prevalent. So you don't go to your parents' house in Mexico City and see a bunch of Mexican people running around. It's all Eastern European style.
Yeah.
Wow.
Everyone looks like me.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So then they're there, they're succeeding, they're doing the thing. They have kids, right? They start to build this community. Then your parents come along.
Yeah, so the community grew. It grew pretty substantially. I don't know the size of the population, but it's big. I mean,
mm-hmm.
a couple tens of thousands of Jews in Mexico City. And by and large, as you said, did well, you know, grew industries and have now taken to a place where their families are well off and their families are well off. And
mm-hmm.
usually these populations work pretty closely with one another. In the early 80s, I think my father specifically started to see these trends in Mexico that weren't making him very optimistic that this was going to be a good place to raise a family. So he had two young daughters at the time, and they were expecting another. And, you know, honestly, I'm not sure what the final straw was that made him say, like, we should get out of here and we should look for a new opportunity for our family. But they really pioneered the movement of Mexican Jewish families moving to the United States. And it really just made sense at that time to look at San Diego, right? It's a border community. If Mexico is the only thing you've ever known, my parents were both born and raised there. They never knew anything else.
Right.
Obviously staying near Mexico made a lot of sense. Right. Yeah. I know. One of the stories that my dad used to tell me was that when he first moved here, and he came first before my mom and my two older sisters, just to look at land and, you know, buy a property and figure out what the process of moving to a new country is going to be like. He said that he had the option of buying a house on Mount Soledad or in Chula Vista. And it made perfect sense for him to buy the house in Chula Vista because it was just closer to Mexico. But now, I wish we had the Mount Soledad house. So he came out here and prospected and eventually brought my mom and my sisters out. And, you know, they've done various different, you know, entrepreneurial moves to make such a move possible because they didn't obviously have any sort of support system here.
Right.
You know, my parents didn't really speak English when they moved here. They spoke a little English
from... Born and raised in Mexico.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they had a bakery when they first moved here and have since had multiple businesses, which somehow played off of the fact that they have this Mexican upbringing and this comfort. So like my father had a factory in Mexico making Tiffany chandeliers, stuff that he was professionally well suited to do because he had this experience managing a workforce and managing a workforce in Spanish and managing a workforce in a country like Mexico, which is really different than running a business here. There's a lot more handshake deals, right? There's a lot less regulation. So I would say that, you know, an American businessman trying to run business over there would be a little bit less successful because there's less institutional regulation. You kind of, you have to be more resourceful. You just kind of figure out how to get stuff done.
So they come here and this is what, the early 80s?
Yeah, I think they came in 80 or 81.
Okay. And so the immigration like path is actually probably much different than it is today, I would imagine.
Yeah, for them, they came and were able to get green cards. Probably because they had some sort of a professional background where they could say, like, yes, we're going to come here and create industry and we're not going to be a drain.
Pre-lottery system, which is kind of how it is now, where it's kind of random.
Yeah, I assume it was much easier back then.
Yeah.
And since they've, my father and two sisters have become citizens. So, I mean, they're here to stay. But yeah, I don't think it was as challenging then to come over here as it is now.
And then you're born here in San Diego.
Yeah.
And what was life like growing up here with Mexican parents?
Yeah, so I was the only one in my family born in San Diego. I'm the only American born in the family. And I mean, we spoke Spanish exclusively in the household. It wasn't even something that was discussed. That was just the language in which we communicated. And my job was really learning English outside of the household. And, you know, we were talking earlier, it's not necessarily something that's challenging to a toddler or a child, right? You watch TV in English, you go to school and you speak English there and you obviously you pick it up. So it's really now been more of a process of retaining Spanish versus like, I don't see myself as a ESL. Like I didn't learn English as my second language. I learned English and Spanish at the same time and now have to maintain Spanish as my second language.
Yeah. There's a word for that. I did some research. I believe it's a compound bilingual. Like if you hear a Spanish word, your brain does not have to translate it. Whereas my brain learning Spanish way later in life, no matter like if I moved to Mexico tomorrow and just spoke solely Spanish for now the rest of my life, I would always be translating those words. Even if it was so minute of a quick translation, it's still my brain because it didn't develop in those same ways. I'll always have that. And I'll also never have the true nuance and understanding of the language that you will. Right. So that's where like for us, it's super important with Jack that we want him to grow up knowing both, just ingrained in him. So there's no concept of like even Jenny's cousins, we interviewed one of them recently and you ask him like, when did you feel like you knew Spanish? And he's like, I don't remember, because I don't remember a time I didn't know Spanish. Like, I don't, and it, there is no like, I decidedly learned it. It just like, it was.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I feel the same way with both English and Spanish.
Right.
I feel like I probably learned them both at the same time.
Yeah. And then, so growing up here, you said, so in school, you're just in regular public school, whatever, yeah, right? But there were day camps you went to?
Yeah, so there's a, since my parents moved here, and they were one of the first families to come over from Mexico City to San Diego, as this kind of Jewish immigration, as things potentially were worsening out there, many more families have come since, mm-hmm, and have created a community, just like they were very used to having a very tight-knit community there. The only thing that they knew how to do was build the same thing here. So right, most of the Jewish Mexican families that live in San Diego live in the same neighborhoods, mm-hmm, and go to the same synagogues and put the children in the same school, and similarly built this community, mm-hmm, I guess like hybrid day camp, Boy Scouts, summer camp model, right, where, yeah, I'd say every Saturday from age 3 to 15, I spent all day with...
Every Saturday?
Yeah, every Saturday, wow, of the school year. And then in the summer, we have the summer camp, which was
every day. So, forgive my ignorance, but so is that when you go to church or to temple? Is on Saturday or is
no,
that
on Sunday? No, it's on Friday night.
Friday night, okay.
Yeah, so Friday night and Saturday morning, but... Most of the Jews that live in Mexico City and then have subsequently moved here are not very religious.
Oh, okay.
So an Orthodox Jew is going to go to synagogue on Friday night and on Saturday morning and then like do, you know, stuff all Saturday day and then Saturday night. Whereas,
yeah,
I'd say a more common Mexican Jewish individual might go on Friday nights, which is Shabbat, and mm-hmm, then that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So yeah, Saturday was just the day where, you know, we'd get dropped off at noon and picked up at 5 or 6 and... We'd play sports and we'd do activities, and there was Jew stuff tied into it, and almost all of that was run in Spanish as well.
Interesting, yeah.
And then over time, I think that more, a few American families have started putting their kids into, mm-hmm, this.
So was there a connection to the, I assume that there was already somewhat of a Jewish, like an American or English-speaking Jewish population here, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, was there a connection there, or is it like, no, you know, because we speak Spanish primarily, we're going to keep separate, or was it like... You know, like one week a year, you go to like its bigger, you know, Saturday thing or something.
Yeah, it was actually pretty isolated. And I felt, so I went to a private Jewish school from 4th to 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And even at that school, there was a pretty big split between the Spanish speaking and American Jews.
Really?
So, no, it really wasn't a kind of a broader community.
That's such an interesting little cultural niche, yeah, you know? I mean, I just would imagine that. So it's almost like the, do you think it's the language or the Mexican, you know, cultural background that keeps that niche together? Because I would imagine like, hey, we're all Jewish here. Being Jewish is a smaller percentage of the population already in America in the grand scheme of things. So like, it's almost like, hey, let's all just like stick to it together. But it's like, no, we're going to do our own thing. Is it a language barrier or cultural?
No, I'd say it's exclusively cultural. And that's a great question. It's a funny nuance. I think in Mexico in general, and maybe throughout Latin America, but my experience is predominantly in Mexico. There's a really different way in which the community looks at, how you live and looks at rules, for example. So I know for me growing up and looking at me and my Mexican Jewish friends versus kind of the American kids that we met, like they were all nerdy and too like straight for us. And we still, I think, like look at, in Mexico, rules are fluid, right? It's not like rules are firm in the United States. This is where you can park your car and this is where you cannot. This is where you can build a house and this is where you cannot. This is the type of business you can run and this is the type of business you cannot.
Right.
And we were all raised to be like, if you want something, just do it.
Yeah.
And obviously that goes to a certain extreme that I think has really negative impacts on society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Mexico experiences that really substantially. But in our life, from a really innocent perspective, when you're 8 and 10 and 13 years old, it really just means like, just do whatever you want. Like,
yeah.
We always looked at our American counterparts as total squares for my whole life.
You're just like, yeah, I don't want to hang out with those guys. God, they're so like, you know, by the book.
Yeah. Like we didn't have... curfews, right? Or like, there weren't movies that I wasn't allowed to watch when I was a kid. And that's just how it played out in my childhood.
Interesting.
It was kind of like, We just did what we wanted.
Did you, so sidebar on that, just because I'm a parent now and I think about this stuff. Did you feel at all like you really wanted something like candy or play video games or something like that, that you couldn't get? Or because things were so fluid, it was like you could do whatever you wanted, so you didn't have this obsessive desire for something?
Yeah, I'd say the latter. And I mean, I also have to say, like, I have phenomenal parents, so
yeah,
that really helped guide. But they, again, they still kind of looked at it like, I don't think I had the parents that were like, you can never eat sugar.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like you have that micromanager, the helicopter parent now you hear of in the United States. It was more just like, yeah, you don't really want things because you don't know that you're not allowed to have them.
Right. You want what you want because you want it, not because you can't have it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like we know some other other friends where they grew up and they were restricted greatly for very good reasons, like no television. And I don't mean like don't watch it, like we don't have one. Right. And there's no possible way. So then they would go to their friend's house and all they want to do is watch TV.
Yeah.
Right. And so the complete absence of something kind of made it worse on the kids, you know, versus like, I don't know, some sort of moderation or in your case, like, hey, like, you know, more fluid type rules.
Yeah. And that's how I think it's just less of a rigid society in Mexico than it is here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So now you're here, you grow up here. Do you identify as Mexican? Do you identify as San Diegan? I mean, what's your, I know you said that you, when you go back to your parents' place in Mexico City, there's kind of this, you know, because you have a gringo accent a little bit.
Yeah. It's so honestly, I don't know what I identify as. I've never really been able to answer that question very well. I guess I use whatever answer best suits me at the time.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're not indigenously Mexican,
right?
Like nobody in my family is Toltec,
mm-hmm.
right? Like they're all Eastern European.
You're not pre-Hispanic.
No.
Right? There's nobody there. Yeah.
No. My parents are Mexican citizens.
Yeah.
Right? And I guess I'm a Mexican citizen by default because both my parents were born there.
Yeah.
And my family, I think, is very grateful to Mexico. But no, I don't necessarily know that I identify as Mexican. Well, I definitely never really identified as American just because I did have this childhood in which I was raised amongst other Mexican Jews and in which we did see this really significant divide between how my family did things and how my friend's family did things.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for example, like growing up, my lunch looked different than every other kid's lunch every single day of first grade to whatever grade you stopped getting lunch. We had like chopped cucumber and jicama and carrots with lime and chili.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we would get like a torta and we would get like, we had Mexican food, and today, like, we eat Mexican food in my house, and that's like a big part of our culture. So I never really felt American per se.
And right, you're not getting spaghetti every night, like
Like my girlfriend's American, and I joke with her family. We have this kind of running thing of things that I've never had before.
Yeah,
because there's this list. Like, I have never had meatloaf before. I've never eaten tuna casserole before. Like, there's this list of things. I've just like,
hamburger
I didn't grow
helper.
Up eating that.
Yeah.
No, never, ever. Right. So we have this like very untraditional upbringing.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question about that, because I've asked this to other, well, to people I know that are like Mexican citizens, like still like born and raised kind of type of thing. Do you enjoy going out to a Mexican restaurant? And by that, I mean like let's say a high-end Mexican restaurant like Bracero or somewhere like that. Like, what's your take on a place like that?
Yeah, I do. I totally do. I think that Mexican food is one of the most underrated cuisines in the world. And I'm really stoked that it's becoming more recognized as such.
Uh-huh.
I remember who the top chef guy is, Rick something in Chicago, that does like really high-end Mexican food.
Yeah.
Paying homage to like the real ingredients and the real foods. I love Mexican food. I absolutely love it. I'm a little limited by the fact that I'm vegan. So
so that cuts out like 80% of Mexican food.
It does.
Because it's all made with pork.
It really shouldn't. Because I have this discussion, and here's like me, a white looking guy, getting into an argument, a friendly argument at like Roberto's, whatever taco stand. And I'm telling the person like, dude, we're from Mexico. We grow all sorts of foods. Like, we don't need to have just tortillas, meat and cheese at our restaurants.
Yeah.
Like, we can have all, like in Mexico, they eat huitlacoche.
Uh-huh.
It's this mushroom that grows on corn exclusively.
Right.
Right. They eat flor de calabaza. It's like the flower that grows on the squash plant.
Uh-huh.
They eat all sorts of really, really beautiful
yeah.
Foods. And
right.
In Mexico, you can grow almost anything. But here now we have these Mexican restaurants in San Diego, and maybe it's not the higher end ones, but it's like, literally you walk in and it's meat, cheese, and tortilla.
Comida de los norteños.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. But it, to that point, I mean, the interesting perspective I had heard was a guy I met from La Paz in Baja Sur, or that's where he's from. He gave me an analogy. He said, you know, it's like if I took you to Mexico and I was like, you have to try this hamburger place. It's the best hamburger place you'll ever have. And I go there and I'm like, well, I'm American. I eat hamburgers. I've been eating hamburgers since I was five. Like, it's okay, but it's like, it's only going to be a hamburger. Yeah. So his perspective was very much like, there is no such thing as like really high quality, high end, amazing Mexican food. And I'm just like, are you kidding me? This is so good. You know? And it's just like, for him, he was saying it was just a difference of culture. So,
I mean, I would also just say that from a produce perspective, and I know we are fortunate to live in California. We grow the majority of the nation's food here.
Yeah.
But if in your travels, you get to spend a significant amount of time in Mexico, you'll notice, I mean, the food there is just a special kind of fresh.
Yeah.
They have some phenomenal food down there. If you want to eat mango or whatever it may be, it just, everything just tastes a little bit better.
I've not spent time in central, like in Mexico, but even just the places I have been, it's been tremendous. Even in other parts of like Central America, in places too, it's something about not having this big agricultural industry around the food you get makes it so much more fresh and, I don't know, just delicious. Like, we were in Nicaragua, and we're in literally like a village. Maybe there's a couple hundred people that live there. So the food we're eating is like fish that a guy just caught that day, right? And the vegetables and everything are from a farm that's just a mile down the road. Like, it's all just, I guess, like natural food, like what it should be, you know?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, culturally, that's absolutely the case.
Yeah.
And socially, it's the case. And unfortunately, we're now coming into this time and place in which the westernization of countries like Mexico or Nicaragua or Honduras are bringing in more soda and junk food and chips. And you're looking at, I think Mexico was recently one of the most obese countries in the world. And this is one of the
best. And that's not based on rice and beans.
I don't think so.
I've heard that for years.
But yeah, like I know like my grandma still goes to the grocery store and like picks out the specific cheese that she wants that was made that day. And she gets fresh tortillas that were made that day. And she like feels every fruit and vegetable. And like that's how they still shop. It is a very, it kind of has that European flair to it of going and shopping for a day or two instead of going to Costco and shopping for 6 months.
Yeah, right. I can't wait to go. And my brother recently went on a trip where he traveled all around the world, all through Central and South America, and all through Europe and all that stuff. Of all the places he went, he said there's something special about Mexico, and I think it's the food. And I think he's right. You know, because I love Mexican food and all that stuff, but I can't wait to go explore more. More of that, especially in DFA.
Yeah, I went at age 18 through a Central American trip, just backpacking with some friends, and later I met up my sister, and I remember thinking like, oh, cool, like here's an opportunity to eat more of the stuff that I'm accustomed to and get the good stuff. And I was sorely disappointed by just how Costa Rican food and Panamanian food and Nicaraguan food, in my opinion, doesn't stack up to Mexican food. I really believe that Central America, Mexico is like the gem, the culinary gem.
Well, and I think Americans here have this weird perception that like all of Latin America is Mexico food, is the same. Yeah. Like, and even me, I didn't know talking to our Spanish teacher just recently, in Colombia, they don't have tacos.
Yeah.
That's like not a thing. I'm like, what? Like, I'm not going. I'm done. That's it. I'm not going to go now. And because a lot of people just assume that Mexican food is universal or something. Like, it's everywhere. And I think it is, like, the second most popular food here in America, albeit it's mostly, like, you know, Taco Bell and shit like that. But I guess you could say in the style, right? It's one of those things. So, yeah, looking forward to that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, let me ask you about traveling, because I know we talked about this, and I don't know what you'd call it. So you're a white guy, you look just like I do, and you go to a Latin country and you start speaking, you don't sound like me, you don't sound like you're learning. So how do people respond to you, you know, when you sound the way you do but you look the way I do?
Well, I think that that's not exclusively an issue that I deal with when traveling, just because we do have such a significant Latin population in Southern California. So I'll be at the market, right? Or I'll be anywhere and I'll see someone that, it's pretty clear to me. I mean, I try not to judge and assume that that person speaks Spanish, but sometimes I do.
That's the opposite of me.
Yeah, that's
right. I just assume anybody that looks Hispanic, I'm going for it.
Yeah, I'll speak Spanish to people all of the time who respond to me in English because they think that I've probably like maxed out the capacity for my Spanish by making that one comment to them. And I'll it becomes clear pretty quickly. Right?
Yeah.
It's happened to me. I've traveled through Mexico now. I've traveled through Central America. I've spent some time in Spain. And I'd say, 99 times out of 100, people are thrilled to hear someone else speak Spanish that they didn't think was going to. It's kind of like they were tickled. Oh, isn't that nice? That white person speaks Spanish.
Right.
It's like a circus act. It's obviously it's never been a problem before. I'm not sure if everybody realizes just the amount of variety and diversity that there is in Spanish language pronunciation and in verbiage and in sentence structure. So, sometimes I'll go to Tijuana and have a hard time understanding what people are saying, even though I'm fluent in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes without saying like what it's like to travel through Spain.
Yeah.
And then you make it up to Catalunya and then like that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, you were saying people would respond in Catalan instead of speaking Spanish to you.
Yeah, I'd approach people in Barcelona and ask for something in Spanish and they'd respond in Catalan and that's more of a political statement.
Right.
And saying like, no, you're in our house, like you'll speak our language, even though they all speak Spanish there.
Yeah.
It's probably required through the school systems.
It's an interesting story. I mean, when we were there, we went to this place, we were in El Born, and they have this old kind of monument or museum about the cultural revolution oppression, I guess, like the Spanish Inquisition that just like tried to kill off the Catalonian culture and failed. And that's why there's such a strong resurgence now.
Yeah, it's cool. They have a really strong street art scene. So now looking into the modern resistance, right?
Yeah.
So this oppression, it's manifested itself in graffiti.
Yeah.
Throughout Catalonia, you'll see all sorts of political activism spray painted on walls.
Yeah.
Like really beautiful stuff. It's an interesting place.
I think Spain should just embrace it, you know? I think if they just said, okay, fine. We screwed up. Our bad. Like, here's whatever. Like, if there's any like thing that they want besides their own independence, there's any kind of concession to like, look, yes, like we'll... All the forms, legal forms and all that crap will be in your language, you know, because I know that was a big thing when it was like when the Spanish came in, they basically said anything not in Spanish is null and void.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, like all their land and everything was like taken from them. So, you know, that obviously pissed people off.
Right. Well, they'd also lose like 10 out of their best 11 soccer players. So I think that's what Spain's holding on to.
Like, wait a minute. No, we can't do that. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, hey, thanks so much for coming on, man. Best of luck with 1-to-1. I love what you guys are doing. Maybe down the road a bit, we'll come back and talk more in Spanish or something.
Yeah, we'll get my mom on here.
Oh, man. All right, we'll do that.
Thanks, Ben.
All right, thanks, brother.
Hey, guys, thanks for listening. You can find full show notes and images from today's episode at breakingespanol.com. We appreciate you listening and would love to see you back here again, so be sure to subscribe now. We have new episodes weekly. Thanks and see you next time. Adios.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.